You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 20th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Amanda Montell, linguist and host of the Sounds Like a Cult podcast, on her book, Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism. Also on the program today, Democratic Senate leadership pretending once again that the parliamentarian has absolute power, this time over her quashing of immigration reforms. Meanwhile, conservative Democrats attack the reconciliation bill. Manchin wants a delay. Sinema wants to quash the prescription drug discounts. Over the weekend, progressives reiterate, we will not vote for the bipartisan bill without a reconciliation bill up for a vote as well. Speaking of voting, Canadians go to the polls today. The United States admits that its drone strike in Kabul killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, but offers no disciplinary action. Union tentatively approves a deal to end the 6-week Nabisco strike. FDA panel recommends a Pfizer booster for 65 and over. Meanwhile, Pfizer says its study shows safety for kids between 5 and 11 for vaccines. By administration still using Title 42 now to expel thousands of Haitians who have gathered in Texas. France recalls its U.S. and Australian ambassadors over the U.S.-Australia nuclear sub-deal because France had its own, or thought they did, their own $66 billion sub-deal with Australia. Lastly, the UN says that the current national pledges for reduction of CO2 have us on a catastrophic pathway. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. Joining us, of course, as she does every day, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. Yes, I'm here every day. You're here,
I knew as soon as I was going to say that, you were going to bring that up. Mondays are always tough.
Right.
They're tough. I feel a little bit rusty. And then, of course, like you have, you've got to set the tone for the week.
Right. Or I thought you were going to be like, oh, I have a snarky co-host. It puts me down on the reg.
Well, no, that may be the case, but Monday, it just feels like it's all pent up over the weekend. You got
to
get it out.
Yeah, no, understand. It takes me a little while to get back in the swing of talking to a microphone.
Right. Yeah, there you go. So let's get right into this. I am of a couple of different minds of the Pentagon conceding what was pretty clear from a reporting that I think first came from the New York Times at least a week ago, speaking of the drone attack on Kabul as the United States was attempting their withdrawal of not only their forces, but all of the Americans in Afghanistan and folks who had been working with Americans over the past 20 years. In that drone strike, which the military had insisted was successful in taking out or preempting an attack on American forces, they killed 10 people, 7 of whom were children, And some reports suggest that, it was basically an aid worker coming home to his family. I have not ever seen an admission like this, I think, for a long time.
Yeah, and the Trump administration, for that matter, rolled back the transparency provisions about drone strikes, so we don't even have a clear picture of what happened for the 4 years.
Certainly during the Trump years, and we also know that they rolled back the sort of any type of... they made it easier to kill civilians. Now, with that said, this is not unique to Biden or Trump. Obama also really was the one who really ramped up the drone strikes. Now, it was just a question of like the technology really essentially appearing in time for that to happen. Let's play this clip and we'll talk about, you know, why I'm a little bit ambivalent about this admission, although, you know, good.
Better admission than non-admission, but the act is still what it is.
Right.
Good afternoon. I'm here to brief the results of the investigation I directed following the report of civilian casualties from our strike in Kabul on 29 August. Having thoroughly reviewed the findings of the investigation and the supporting analysis by interagency partners, I am now convinced that as many as 10 civilians, including up to 7 children, were tragically killed in that strike. Moreover, we now assess that it is unlikely that the vehicle and those who died were associated with ISIS-K or were a direct threat to U.S. forces. I offer my profound condolences to the family and friends of those who were killed. This strike was taken in the earnest belief that it would prevent an imminent threat to our forces and the evacuees at the airport. But it was a mistake, and I offer my sincere apology. As the combatant commander, I am fully responsible for this strike and its tragic outcome.
Now, what we didn't do was to end that clip just before he offered his resignation.
Or here, take me and prosecute me.
I mean, there is at this point been no indication that anyone is even going to get a demerit as a function of this mistake. Now, I understand that they're really, really apologetic.
He broke out the profound condolences, Sam.
Right. And that is probably the punishment. And I am going to be held to account. And that's why I have to come out and say this. Now, it's a good thing that they're admitting this. It would have been very hard based upon all of the reporting on the ground. But there's a couple things that you should be aware of that seem fairly obvious, but do need to be said. The vast majority of drone strikes that take place are not at the epicenter of the news of the day, where you have, I don't know how many foreign reporters on the ground there to immediately challenge the military's perspective. The military, if they could make this type of mistake in Kabul, imagine the lack of resources that they have and the mistakes that they would make outside of Kabul. And I'm not just talking about in Afghanistan. We could be saying this about Yemen. We could be saying this about, Somalia. We could be saying this about Pakistan. We could be saying this about many, many countries. So it is far more likely that this episode was not the anomaly, but is probably generally more apt to be what the reality is of our drone strike program, that we end up killing more civilians than we do enemy combatants in the final analysis, and that the military is under virtually no pressure to come clean. And I would also add that I think even if we were to trust the military to reassess, right, to do their own investigation, say, you know, we got it wrong, I think the only reason why we're hearing about it in this instance, and that's assuming that they actually do come to the proper to an actual conclusion in other instances. The reason why we're hearing about it in this instance is because Joe Biden is under attack for withdrawing from Afghanistan. And My suspicion is that when they investigated this, and you already had these reports out there, and there was, you know, a lot of on the ground in the moment reporting by the New York Times, Joe Biden was like, you're going out there and you're saying this because this is a reason why we should be leaving Afghanistan. Now, that doesn't mean that Joe Biden's not doing the same thing in some other country. More than likely that we are. But in this instance, things just aligned. So people should understand this. The idea that we're hearing about this is the only thing that's unique about this situation.
Right. And also, of course, as you point out, that there were eyes on it to this degree. I'm sure they would still call this precision strike, a precision strike, right? Even though they're just using cell phone data and there's no way to actually fundamentally know if it's being it's precise in any way. The norm is probably that we kill the wrong people more often than not. And we were talking a little bit about this before the show. We saw a tweet from a Fox News reporter saying that the administration or that the military stands by the intelligence. We don't know if that's actually the quote. That was his characterization. And like you say, it's all an effort to make Biden look bad. So take that for what you will. But operationally, they do still stand by the intelligence because this doesn't cause a wholesale reevaluation of the drone program in and of itself.
Of course.
So they'll move on from this. We'll move forward. If they actually were serious and wanted to offer, what kind of condolences was it? The most
profound.
Profound condolences. What would be profound is to end the drone program.
I mean, let's put it this way. If we don't hear about the punishments that come from this abject failure, can you, I mean, like, you imagine how often we don't even hear about the abject failures, right? I mean, this is the one, this is their showpiece.
Yeah, because they just imply that, okay, we killed some civilians, but also maybe there was some intelligence. We got a good bad guy in there, too.
And right. Then,
yeah.
Yes, perhaps another, like, wholesale reevaluation needs to be done on the nature of intelligence and how intelligent intelligence can be, and what that leads to in terms of, like, you know, state-sponsored murder.
Right. I mean, the bottom line is this doesn't work. It doesn't work. It didn't work in Afghanistan for 20 years. It didn't work. And the thing that drives it forward is just cash. That's basically it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Amanda Montell. She's a linguist and host of the Sounds Like a Cult podcast. Her latest book, Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism. But first, we have some sponsors today. One is from Stitch Fix. And I guess I jumped the gun a little bit in getting that sweater. I don't know what I was thinking. It's not. It's still hot here. But I got a great...
Oh.
Like it's like a cardigan, but a zip-up cardigan.
Oh,
sort of like baseball style.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sitting off the top of my cubby. Head, I don't remember which sweaters you own.
Now you know your closet well, right? I presume.
Yes.
Right. But what does it sound like?
My closet.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing.
Does it whisper your taste, or does it scream your taste?
It screams.
Yeah.
That
well,
it's
with Stitch Fix Freestyle. A shop that evolves alongside your taste, your closet will scream absolutely you without actually screaming. This is they're introducing Stitch Fix Freestyle. It's a shop built just for you. Stitch Fix Freestyle is your trusted style destination where you can discover and instantly buy curated items based on your style, likes, and lifestyle. Whether you're looking for a brand you love or try a new one, at Stitch Fix Freestyle, you can shop hundreds of brands personalized to your size and fit. They got styles for workouts, to workwear, lounging, night out on the town. Stitch Fix Freestyle has clothes for any occasion. Plus, there's no subscription required, and they offer free shipping, returns, and exchanges. I got to say, this is the way that I've been using Stitch Fix. They hadn't quite developed this whole thing where you just go in, they give you more things, but I've been periodically going in and doing my likes, thumbs up or thumbs down on stuff. And so they've been presenting me with stuff that is like getting increasingly more like what I wear. Now there's still enough like variant so that I don't get in a rut, which I think if anybody who's watched me over the years knows that I'm in a massive clothing rut. I have been for 25 years. Although I will say this, I don't know if people have noticed this, but I wear a lot less checks on my shirts. that's basically just because of what we were doing with Zoom, and it was
video software.
Yeah, it was video software. But I branched out on sweaters that reintroduced me to five pocket jeans. It's been great. Get started today by filling out your style quiz at stitchfix.com/majority. That's stitchfix.com/majority to try Stitch Fix Freestyle. stitchfix.com/majority. Folks, you know that one of the things that people like, and apparently customers also like, is stuff that's on demand. Customers have grown to expect a simpler way to do business. Doesn't matter what your product is. That's why more than 90,000 local businesses of all size have turned to Podium. Doesn't matter whether you have one location or 1,000, Podium can help you stay ahead. What is Podium? It is a service that makes doing business as easy as sending a text. So all your employees can text from a single inbox, offering a smoother experience for your customers. Doesn't matter whether you're answering questions, collecting reviews, scheduling appointments and deliveries, or dealing with payment collection, all you have to do is just send a text. Car dealerships are selling more cars by offering text messaging. One dealer apparently sold a $50,000 truck in four text messages. What is that, like an F-250? No, it's like an F-350. Retailers are increasing their revenue by allowing customers to shop via text message. Many people still want to shop from home. Well, Podium knows of a jeweler that just sold a $5,000 ring with a few text messages and even coordinated curbside pickup with Podium. Today's customers expect on-demand everything, even from local businesses. You got to check this out. Stay ahead of the competition with Podium. They have free plans for growing businesses, plus all the power growing businesses need to scale. Get started for free today at podium.com/majority. That's podium.com/majority. Okay, want to welcome to the program Amanda Montell. She's a linguist and host of Sounds Like a Cult podcast. Her second book is out, Cultish. It's the language of fanaticism. Amanda, welcome to the show. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Thank you so much for having me.
This feels really particularly timely, because it feels like everything has become culty these days. And you use the term cultish. Let's just start there for a second. What does that mean? Like, why cultish? And give us like sort of what this, I guess, matter of degree scale is.
Sure. Well, when I started writing this project, I was hoping that my personal understanding of the word cult would become more definitive, more succinct. But in fact, the opposite was the case. I found that this word is so subjective and has become so sensationalized and oftentimes so filled with judgment that it's really not specific enough to determine what actual dangers are on the table when you're discussing any particular group. Scholars who discuss new religious movements, alternative religions, and the sociology of them don't even really use the word cult, at least not in formal settings, for these reasons. They've tried to come up with lists of criteria distinguishing a cult from a better accepted religion or another kind of mainstream social group, and they've never been able to agree. So for this reason, I try to either be very specific with my language and call something a fringe religion, a destructive new religion, if that's the case, or I'll sort of hedge and call it cultish. And so in the book, I talk about this wide range of cultish groups, some of which are really nefarious and some of which are fairly harmless. But all of these groups use these techniques of cultish language to influence us in ways that we can't even see.
For the sake of this conversation, like what, how do we distinguish between nefarious and harmless? Do we have a timeline on this, or is it, that's really sort of the problem, right? I mean, that's the delineation between cults and religion, or...
There really is no delineation, because you can go down that list of criteria that people have tried to describe. Okay, us versus them mentality, ends justify the means philosophy, charismatic power, abusive leaders, supernatural beliefs. You can go down that list, and then there are plenty of groups that have been or could be called cults that won't check off most of the boxes, and yet you'll have plenty of mainstream groups, traditional religions, government bodies, Silicon Valley companies that really, really do. So it's quite challenging, and you have to sort of pay more attention to what's going on than simply labeling a group a cult.
All right. With that said, I guess what we're looking at is a process of really sort of some measure of indoctrination, and whether it leads to something that is nefarious or causes people problems or not is almost sort of secondary to, I think, what you've written here. With that said, before we get into sort of like the push aspects, what are there targets or individuals who are more or less susceptible to this process of, I don't know, indoctrination with language?
Yeah, you know, I believed the lore before I started writing this book that those who wind up in cults are desperate, intellectually deficient, disturbed in some way. But what I found interviewing source after source, survivors of some of the most notorious cults of all time, including Jonestown and Heaven's Gate, was that they were incredibly bright, service-oriented. They had this grand vision for a better world. And their fatal flaw was really not desperation. It was this overabundance of optimism. It was this faith that solutions to the world's most urgent problems could be found. And by affiliating with this group, with this confident guru or charismatic leader, that they could be a part of that change. So it was a combination of, you know, certain amounts of privilege. You know, if you don't have money to spare, if you don't have lots of friends and connections, you're probably not going to be very attractive to a cult. So the type of person most susceptible to these sorts of groups was really the opposite to what I thought. I thought myself, I'm so skeptical. You know, I am such a cynic. I would never find myself involved with a cultish group. But when I think about it, you know, I've been in my fair share of toxic one-on-one relationships, which are really just cults of one. I've been in my fair share of really strange parasocial relationships with social media gurus myself. So, yeah, really the susceptible, vulnerable person is not who you might think.
But to what extent does, the overwhelming amount of information these days, the lack of clarity, I guess, you know, just sort of modernity as it exists today, also sort of, I guess, you know, make that attractive. I mean, it's one thing to feel like you're optimistic that there's a silver bullet to this, but it also may be that you are overwhelmed with what you perceive as all the problems or questions.
That's true. So, right, we can backtrack even further. Cults tend to peak in the United States during times of cultural turbulence, when the institutions that are supposed to provide us with support, government, the healthcare system, religion, traditional religion, that is, seem to be failing us. And so you're right, we're overwhelmed by the onslaught of tumult. And so we often find that we want to turn to alternative groups to fill those voids of community, connection, purpose, meaning, ritual. And sometimes those alternative groups end up being net positive, and sometimes they end up being really destructive. So I think the human craving for sort of closure and clarity and comfort during times of crisis is really deeply ingrained and not at all a bad thing. It's simply when people exploit it, that's when it becomes a bad thing.
And you talk about the, I think, influence of people who are more, the targeting of people who don't have ties and are a bit more atomized. And I'd imagine that increases during, you know, this era where we all are so isolated in our own ways. And like, there seems to be this specific targeting of suburban women or suburbanites in general to cult-like things. I mean, I don't know if it's a pyramid scheme or a cult in general, but there are things that feel cult-ish, as you write or as you say, that seem to be attracting a growing number of people just through online marketplaces and discourse.
Yeah, sure. So people who are vulnerable in one way or another, who do feel like the system is failing them, certainly are a bit more vulnerable to these groups. And yes, sort of white suburban mom types tend to be the target for a lot of these groups, from conspirituality to multi-level marketing. And there's definitely some overlap there in terms of the Venn diagram. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people have been reaching out to me to comment on the recent Amazon Prime docuseries, Lula Rich. And it's interesting, I write about MLMs in my book, and there's so much to unpack there. But yeah, I mean, MLMs we think of as scams, but they're not just your average scams. They're much cultier than that. They are these life-consuming organizations that have pervasive missionary ideologies, founding leaders that members come to worship on the level of a spiritual leader, who are promising not just financial benefits, but benefits to your very life purpose and afterlife. A lot of MLMs are Christian or Mormon affiliated. That is no accident. They really appeal to people who were brought up under some version of the prosperity gospel, the idea that monetary blessings, hashtag blessings, and heavenly blessings are inherently connected, that God helps those who help themselves, and that, you know, meritocracy is real. And if you truly work hard enough, it doesn't matter if the system is predatory and doomed, like, you will achieve not only success, but enlightenment. That is an incredibly compelling message to all Americans, really, but especially, you know, certain people who are locked out of the dignified labor market, including homemakers, white suburban women.
Right, right. I mean, and that, and then it also allows them in some of these MLMs a way to, or the prospect of not passive income, which is not true, like they're still working, but an ability to juggle being a mother while also being a part of this larger community where they may not feel connected, have to stay at home. And then, you know, they can make money for their family and exist in capitalism while still having the job of being a mom.
Absolutely. So the multi-level marketing industry has always riffed on whatever female empowerment buzzwords were trendy at the time. So in the 40s, Tupperware was promised to be the best thing that happened to women since they got the vote. And now MLMs like LuLaRoe and Arbonne and Young Living are promised to be the priceless opportunity to be part of an organic, holistic movement, to be the girl boss you really are, to be a mompreneur, to be a CEO, to work part-time from home, making a full-time living without having to leave your kids. So I don't want to say programs, but we are conditioned heavily to resonate with this certain commodified feminist message. At least a certain slice of us are.
Yeah.
I mean, that capitalism is driving a lot of that, right? I mean, in that narrow field, I mean, all of it.
Yeah. I mean, we're all brought up with the Protestant capitalist ethic that started hundreds of years ago in Europe. We're brought up to value individualism, ambition, self-improvement, progress, meritocracy. The stuff is deeply embedded, even if you don't consider yourself Protestant or religious in that way, even if you don't consider yourself particularly entrepreneurial.
All right, let's go back to this process in which people are pulled in, and it is all centered around. Well, I mean, is it? Well, I don't know. This is like one of those egg chicken things. But is this process exclusively, or at least primarily, a function of language, or is that you're a linguist and so you're looking at that aspect of it?
I mean, that's my argument. Certainly without language, you cannot have ideology, you cannot have beliefs, you cannot have community. Without language, you cannot have cults. My argument is that, you know, in the media, you tend to hear one pretty flimsy explanation for why people end up in cults: brainwashing. They were brainwashed, they were mind controlled. But brainwashing is nothing but a metaphor. It's not a real or testable phenomenon. It doesn't meet the criteria of the scientific method. You can't prove that brainwashing doesn't exist. And people tend to take language for granted. We grow up with axioms like sticks and stones can break your bones, but words will never hurt you and such. And we don't stop to appreciate the really material value that it has to control people, to influence people in ways that they can't even see. So my argument is really to shed a light on these linguistic techniques that are influencing you in ways that have nothing to do with a rural commune, a shaved head, a white robe, the classic cult things.
Talk about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. I was unfamiliar with that hypothesis. What is that?
Sure.
My mispronunciation of
it. No, that's perfect. Well done. This is something you learn about in linguistics. The superior hypothesis talks about the relationship between language and thought. So while language does not determine thought, you can have thoughts for which there is no linguistic label. It does influence thought. So this relates to the concept of cult language, because we think about brainwashing in terms of like, oh, these people were once, you know, individuals with their own minds, and then all of a sudden a cult leader got in there and completely wiped their brains clean. But you can't convince someone to believe something that they on no level want to believe. You can only coax them to believe slightly more and more and more radical versions of what they're already open to. And certainly if you want to push back, even if you grow up in a cult and their language is all you know, if you have a certain skepticism inside of you or a certain questioning, if you don't want to believe in what sounds to be malarkey, you can push back even if you don't have language. And I interviewed some people who grew up from birth in cults like the Children of God, who just always had this inkling, even though there was a euphemism, a piece of loaded language, an us-them label, a thought-terminating cliche to shut them down, they still could feel in their bones that something was wrong.
I mean, so is that dynamic, is it you're increasing the intensity or decreasing the intensity of a belief, or does it have the ability to shift a belief, or is it that we have, you know, walking around, I have five alternative beliefs, essentially, you know, and I'm operating on one belief system, but I have five others. And if it's triggered, that dial can be turned up, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, social science of belief. It's so interesting. I mean, I could have written this book for 10 more years, at least. I think, you know, we grow up because of our background and our lifestyles and all the circumstances that make us who we are. We are open to certain beliefs, and I think we're just completely closed off to others. But something that is universally true is that we crave connection, purpose, meaning, ritual, community. Did I say that already? Like, these are the profoundly human things. And depending on nature versus nurture, I don't know, like all of the combination of things that make us unique, we might be amenable to a certain belief system rather than another. For example, Heaven's Gate, the UFO millenarian cult that claimed 39 people's lives in the late 90s. That cult arose during the digital technology revolution, when all of a sudden, you know, computers were providing new and interesting answers to humanity's oldest questions. Why are we here? What happens when we die? Heaven's Gate rhetoric would not land now very well. It would sound super dated. Talk of the kitchen being the Nutrilab and the laundry room being the fiber lab. And when you're in the mansion, you're in craft. And when you're out of the mansion, you're out of craft. So, like, that feels very dated now. Back then, it felt really resonant. Cults will resonate with certain people depending on their background, depending on the time. It's really complex.
All right. And so one more aspect of this, and then I want to get into more about the language. Is there a Is there a dynamic where there's a certain, I guess, I don't know how to describe it, intensity level or fanaticism that is transferable? In other words, like, you know, I've seen research that shows, like, the biggest converts from one religion to another are the ones who are looking for, from a generic standpoint, the same type of structure, maybe, but they're just changing what those beliefs are. In other words, are there a finite number of people who are susceptible to cults? They don't necessarily have to be in cults, but they are susceptible because, or going down a certain path, because there could be an intensity about yoga at one point, but then it becomes about spaceships, or then it becomes about just going to church.
Yeah, I don't know if there is a finite number of people. This is a complicated question because, again, it depends on your definition of the word cult. I mean, there would be people that would argue that I'm in a cult because I voted for Joe Biden and because I used to be vegan. Like, there is so much subjectivity there. Like, what even is a cult? But yeah, I think that there are certain people who, again, because of their background and some like incredibly complex amalgam of factors, are more susceptible to certain metaphysical ideas. I mean, there have been studies done on the connection between intelligence and certain metaphysical beliefs at education levels. Gender might have an effect on whether or not you're more likely to believe in New Age beliefs or conspiratorial beliefs, which are growing to be more and more of the same thing every day. But yeah, and I think, you know, we have certain patterns. So it's almost like the process of someone going from one abusive relationship to another. Like, I spoke to a really fascinating source in the book who was a survivor of Jonestown, the most famous, infamous cult tragedy of all time. What did she do? She went and joined another cult right away, which just so happened to be the cult where my dad spent his teenage years against his will, which is a huge inspiration for the book. That group was called Synanon. So she just really was not willing to give up on the idea that, again, solutions to these urgent problems in the world, classism, racism, sexism, could be found in a commune. And yeah, after the two destructive cult experiences, she finally gave up on that. But yeah, it's complicated, of course.
Well, I guess twice. That's not, I mean, and we should say, your book points out that drinking the Kool-Aid, you know, it comes from Jonestown.
Comes from Jonestown, and it wasn't even Kool-Aid.
You know, that growing up, I thought it was Kool-Aid.
What was it?
It was just bug juice.
It was a shelf brand. It was called Flavor-Aid, and Kool-Aid has just become a genericized trademark, like when you call all adhesive bandages Band-Aids, even though there are other brands.
Wow. That's right. That's the same with Kleenex. Kool-Aid must have really enjoyed that.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the taxonomy of what you call cultish language, right? There is a redefinition of existing words. And we were joking beforehand that maybe we would bring you on as being like, this is the first time she's coming on as a knowledge giver.
Welcome to mothership.
Yeah, exactly. But explain that concept and what the value to creating a cult is.
Yeah. So when you take existing language that we've grown up our whole lives using and you slowly and deliberately twist the meaning of it so that you've shed the old meaning and infused it with a new cult meaning, that can, first of all, help psychologically separate you from the rest of the world because they're all using language to mean one thing and now you're using it to mean another. So it creates that us-them dichotomy. It's also a form of gaslighting when you deliberately convince someone that the language they've always known does not mean what you think it means. It actually means something else. We as humans are innately averse to those high levels of internal conflict, so we feel the need to default to the nearest confidently speaking authority figure to tell us what we need to do to feel safe. And then those words with their new cult-specific meanings become emotionally charged, so they can be used as threats. I have an example early in the book where I talk about how a former member of the group, the Happy, Healthy, Holy Organization, 3HO, they're the Kundalini Yogis. They own Yogi Tea, fun fact. You can find it in any grocery store. Isn't that frightening? They had this term old soul to, you know, an average American English speaker is a compliment. It means someone who's wise beyond their years. But in 3HO, it was this threat. It was this menacing thing. It meant someone who'd reincarnated life after life after life, and they could never get it right. So you could control someone's behavior by threatening. You're going to be an old soul. You're going to be on a low vibration, Piscean consciousness. These things sound sort of ridiculous to outsiders, but to those who on the inside who've been conditioned that this is what old soul means, it becomes really powerful.
Talk about the notion of like the in language. I mean, what that does. I mean, I feel like that is one of those things where it's like, well, that you see that in almost everything. On some level, right? I mean, the legal profession, people who watch this show for an extended period of time, there's some shorthands that we use. I mean, how much of it is that and how much of it is and I guess also, how self-consciously does a cult leadership or cultish leadership deploy that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is a difference between cultish language and language that's there in any given field to communicate more effectively. So my parents are research scientists. When they talk at the dinner table, I have no idea what they're saying because they're using like in-group jargon. But that language, those acronyms and special terms, they're there to make language clearer. They're there to make it more succinct. All of that stuff like could not be said in plain English when they're talking about parts of cells and things I don't know about. But cultish language has special in-group terms, but they're not there to make language clearer and more succinct and easier. They're there to make meaning cloudier. They're there to obscure truths. The language is really just there to divide people into an us and a them, to create hierarchies, to warp your perspective or to cause you to mistrust your own reality. The language can be definitely more nefarious in a cult scenario than perhaps on your show, but I don't really know. And cult leaders do tend to be pretty deliberate about it. Like, who doesn't love the feeling of speaking a secret code language? We all remember what it felt like on the playground to learn to speak Pig Latin. You instantly felt not only intellectually, but morally superior to all the kids who couldn't speak it. We love that feeling of exclusivity and intellectual superiority.
But doesn't that to some extent exist, like even in the context of what you're talking about? I'm just thinking about like, you know, I'm most familiar with, you know, sort of legalese, and it may not be deployed for those reasons, although I sometimes wonder, but it does create like a us them. It certainly creates a sense of moral and intellectual superiority.
Totally.
It also reframes questions in a very limited and space. I mean, I don't know if, you know, how much of that is deliberate or if, mm-hmm. how much, but it certainly has all those impacts though, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not super familiar with legalese. I would have to look into it more, but the more you talk about it, the more I think it might have some elements of cultish language. Again, these things fall along a spectrum. So it's not like Jonestown or nothing. Maybe it is like a little bit closer to the more dangerous end of the spectrum than, say, I don't know, Quakers, but who knows? I mean, I used to work in digital media for a beauty magazine, and certainly there was a lot of extremely cultish corporate BS jargon tossed around just to fill those who knew how to use it or thought they knew how to use it with a sense of elitism and to make everyone else feel like they weren't cool and they weren't on the inside. And it was also used as a form of social control, you know, like the language didn't say anything that couldn't be said in plain English, but if you used it, it showed that you were a team player, that you were a conformist, that you deserved promotions, that you deserved more opportunities. And if you didn't use it, if you refused, if you were an iconoclast, that meant that you were a troublemaker and maybe you couldn't be trusted. So there's definitely that intention behind it as well, I think.
Well, that's like what fascinates me so much about, I guess, we can talk a little bit more about QAnon because that's in the news so often. I mean, I find the appeal to one's own sense of narcissism and desire to possess a secret knowledge that elevates oneself ahead of the rest of the general population to be a really tantalizing concept. You've touched on it a bit here, but bringing it into more specific concepts that we've seen, like that seems to be the addictive quality of something like Q.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, those cravings for exclusive knowledge really spike during times of cultural crisis. So there are a lot of questions in our world right now that don't have simple answers to. And when a confident person, or in the case of Q, many different people, I mean, on social media, there are countless cultish leaders just because of influencers and social media. Like now there's really a cult for everyone. But yeah, when someone is confidently stating that they have a simple answer to a complex question, we're really inclined to want to sign up for that, especially with QAnon in the early days, releasing those breadcrumbs or Q drops. It's like gambling, you know, it's like pulling the slots. It's a shot of dopamine every time you look for a new clue, a new term, because QAnon really weaponizes language in a really interesting way. And now the conspirituality community has done that as well. So yeah, it's really preying on our own chemicals that we make in our own body, our own like stress chemicals and happiness chemicals to keep us in, since, you know, QAnon isn't on a rural commune. It's just online.
Talk about thought terminating cliches. What are those?
Sure. So this is one of the most interesting elements of cultish language. It's the sort of thing where once you understand what it is, you won't be able to unhear it. So thought terminating cliche, this was a term that was coined in the early 60s by a psychologist named Robert J. Lifton. And it describes a sort of stock expression that's easily memorized, easily repeated, and aimed at shutting down independent thinking or questioning. So questioning, dissent, scrutiny is obviously the enemy to any cultish group that wants to hide any wrinkles in their logic or, you know, just wants to be able to assert unquestioned power at every turn. And so anytime anyone wants to push back or ask a question or poke holes, you're going to need to have a roster of these stock sayings to shut them down. So in Nexium, for example, if folks are familiar with that group, a thought terminating cliche could come in the form of dismissing a valid concern or anxiety as a limiting belief, or don't let yourself be ruled by fear. Maybe you should sit with that. In QAnon groups and conspirituality groups, classic thought terminating cliche is, well, I did my research, or do your research. Research, of course, to them does not involve peer-reviewed studies or what we would consider, what most of us would consider like actual research, but of course, going down a confirmation bias-filled rabbit hole, revealing, you know, fantasy answers for questions that feel unanswerable. So yeah, the thought terminating cliches are everywhere, and they also show up in our everyday lives. Things like, well, boys will be boys, or it's all in God's plan.
That do your research has been deployed quite a bit lately in terms of vaccinations.
Oh yes. And what is research? Like, what is this research that you're pointing you towards? I mean, it's very
on your phone, right? Check Facebook and see what Facebook is saying about it.
Exactly. It's a very convenient thing to do. And thought terminating cliches are super compelling because they alleviate cognitive dissonance, or that uncomfortable discord when you hold two conflicting ideas in your mind at the same time. It's like, I want to believe in this person who seems very confident and nice and they care about me, but it seems like poppycock. What do I do? Do your research. Okay. All right. I just haven't done the research yet. All right. Or it's just a way to shut someone down so that the conversation will end and that person will go away. So yeah, I mean, anything legitimate will stand up to scrutiny, will stand up to dialogue. Dialogue is, of course, difficult to have on social media sometimes. But yeah, do your research. Classic QAnon to conspirituality thought terminating cliche.
You also talk about like sort of names that nouns that create insider outsider dynamic. Is that seems similar to the idea of redefining words, or does that have a different sort of, does that create a different effect?
Yeah, you're doing that exact same thing of creating that us-them dichotomy. I mean, most religions will give people monastic names. You have a confirmation name, or, you know, a bat mitzvah name, your Hebrew name, whatever. But in certain circumstances, it can be used really purposefully to make someone shed their identity, to leave behind everything they knew in the past, to leave behind everyone on the outside of the group and move forward with this new identity. Again, in that group 3HO that I mentioned, everybody was assigned a name by a name giver who used tantric numerology to come up with a person's new name. Everybody had the same last name. In Heaven's Gate, everybody shed their old name and was either given or chose a name for themselves, but it always had the same suffix, which was Odi. And some people think that was a sort of combination of the two leaders whose cult names were T and Doe. So your name might be Chakotay or Andoni or Silvodi. And it sounds silly, but it really was incredibly symbolic of these people's new identities and shedding of the old. And it was doing real religious work.
Does that also work in the terms of, like, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about it in the context of like online political discourse and maybe an offline political discourse as well. But there has been like a rise in the idea of having to, you know, sort of subcategories of political identification that just seem to have maybe have always existed on some level, these subcategories, but they certainly have feel like they've proliferated. Is that part of it too?
I don't talk about this in my book or in cultish very much, but yes, I think, you know, we as human beings really crave taxonomy. We crave labels, and labels can be really powerful in legitimizing an experience, whether that experience already had a name or not. What comes to mind is cancel culture. Like, there were already names for canceling someone before we had the term cancel. There was accountability. There was bullying. There was public shame. You know, we already had that term or those terms, but then the word canceled became almost this like piece of loaded language that everybody should now fear. So yeah, I think we really just inherently crave a sort of categorization system to help us understand the world and ourselves.
I mean, the cancel thing seems also odd, too, because it's so entertainment based, right? I mean, it's just based upon the idea of your favorite program not being on anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I make the argument all the time that I think cancel culture is more about catharsis than actual change. But that's a different conversation.
Yes.
Well, yes. Yeah. Sure.
What is there to be done about this? I mean, is there a and why would I do something about it? I mean, is it just a way of trying to provide people with the ability to get a sense of like, how deep am I getting into something? Or is it just sort of a way to examine, how some form of manipulation is going on?
Yeah, it's all of those things. I mean, the reason why I didn't just talk about Jonestown, Heaven's Gate, and Scientology in the book is because I'm inviting us all to consider that cultish influence isn't simply found in those cinematic cult-like places that evoke Midsommar or whatever. It's all around us, and none of us are above it. And I've even, I've been humbled while writing the book as someone who considers themselves very cult phobic, very skeptical. It's an invitation to consider the cultish influence that you're under, whether it's on social media or in your startup or in your fitness studio, not to be wary of it, not to be paranoid, but just to make sure that when you return from whatever space you're engaging in, that you're able to strip off their linguistic uniform, if you will, and go back to an identity that is more complex than any one given ideology, group, guru. And it's also an exercise in empathy. I mean, I thought those same things before writing this book, that people who wind up in cults are desperate, disturbed, totally different from me. But the fact that we're all susceptible to this type of influence, and that doesn't make you an idiot, it just makes you human and someone who craves answers, I think can really help heal a lot of connections.
Is there any sort of like comprehensive history of this, like to contextualize like where we are in the modern history as to the use of this language or the susceptibility to this language? Because it feels like we're, 50 years from now, this era will seem unique. But the combination of like the development of social media, the social upheaval that is happening that may or may not actually be a part of that, seems like we are uniquely situated for this type of language and impulse to increase. And also, I would say probably the diminishment of religion, which I think sort of like sopped up some of the impulse for this stuff.
Absolutely. So I talk about all of these factors and the history of it in part one of the book. I think this time in history will be considered unique, just as the 60s and 70s were considered unique in terms of all of the new religious movements that emerged during that time, which some scholars refer to as the Fourth Great Awakening. Maybe this is the Fifth Great Awakening. I mean, there tend to be these periods in history, again, when these factors will come in that leave people feeling existentially unmoored. And this is when cult language has its strongest effect. I talk about it in the book. I looked elsewhere. I looked for sources that would neatly package the history so that I could, pilfer from that. But unfortunately, there is no one single source that goes into super, super nitty gritty detail about it all. But it is overviewed in part one of Cultish.
Well, we're a political show. So, I mean, I think we're at least I'm primarily, or not primarily, but a little bit more interested in just like the political ramifications of this as well, because I feel maybe like in terms of this being an inflection point in history, cult language and cult like thinking being this prominent of a part of our politics. I mean, I don't know. It seems unique to me.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely a part of our politics. I touch on that a bit in the book. I thought I barely touched on it at all. I touched on it enough that there are some people who are triggered. But yeah, I think that political parties and candidates absolutely make use of this cultish language and the various techniques. They have to.
Then we've used it as a handbook in order to indoctrinate people and to sell more merch.
Yes,
so,
right.
Much appreciated. Amanda Montell, the book is, sounds, excuse me, I should say the podcast is Sounds Like a Cult, and it's Cultish, the Language of Fanaticism. We've got links to both at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick respite. That's what we call it, instead of a break.
Right.
I know. I'm so excited about that.
The commissaries are only your like cult language.
Well, I guess that's
the
true.
The commissaries where we drink the Kool-Aid.
Right. People understand.
Right.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. I just want to play this next clip because, one, I really appreciate the sentiment, and I know Mike. He is a he's a good guy, but this is he is a an Iraq war vet, and he attended a George W. Bush speaking event. I think it was in Beverly Hills, California, on Sunday, and he took the opportunity to speak to George Bush, and I think this is actually, we should have more of this.
And the president's got a lot of really smart people at his disposal. And I used him, and Dad used him, and he was his favorite smart people. But it was awesome to have him. And Mother, of course, was around too. And
Mr. Bush, when are you going to apologize for the million Iraqis that are dead because you lied! You lied about weapons of mass destruction! You lied about connections to 9/11! You lied about Iraq being a threat! You sent me to Iraq! You sent me to Iraq in 2003! My friends are dead! Joshua Castillo! You killed people! You lied! You lied about WMD! A million Iraqis are dead because you lied! My friends are dead because you lied! You need to apologize! Apologize! Apologize!
Are you with this gentleman?
No. No.
You know, one of the things
is
I don't
is she with
miss,
this gentleman? Did she come in with him or is she with you?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
The so idea, you behave? Who said that on stage?
I don't know who provided that, but you know, the reformation of George W. Bush at this time. There was, I saw a report that Bush and Obama and Clinton were getting together with their the respective first wives to welcome Afghan refugees here. And it just, the Reformation Project, there is a direct line to allowing our politicians to get away with, you know, what ultimately ends up being mass murder,
war crimes,
and war crimes, lying us into a war, and the sort of just sweeping away of, by any numbers, you want it to be 200,000 like the Defense Department, or a million by most of the reputable accounting of the deaths of Iraqi civilians. it begins to eat away at a country. And, you know, to hail George Bush, to have him being able to go out and now being just the guy who gives candies to first ladies is a real problem, I think, on our history. So,
and credit to Mike for focusing on the 1 million Iraqis, estimated estimates go back and forth, but that's one of them, and not just United States troops, which is the only thing that's dominant in our politics when we talk about this illegal war.
And you can check out Empire Files, which is a show Mike produces with Abby Martin, who is it's good stuff. All right, folks, if you're watching us on Peacock, we will say goodbye to you and see you tomorrow. And for the rest of you, we see you here now.
Hello.
Hi. What's up? Welcome to Monday. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. We got plenty more to talk about. And try and catch you up on the latest of what's happening with the reconciliation bill. Oof. Also, the debt limit is coming closer. We will get to all of that. But before we do, I want to remind you, this show relies on you for its fuel, for keep on chugging. If you want to help this show thrive and survive, become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the first half of the show, but you also get extra content virtually every day.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. It's nuts. So check it out. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Also, don't forget, JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. And we've got our AM Quickie. Head to Majority.fm. Scroll down to the bottom. Put your email in there. You'll get an email blast every morning. Short one gets you some of the top stories and some of the stories that you probably would miss. So check that out. Don't forget, Nomi Show, youtube.com/ The Nomiki Show. The Nomiki Show. There we go.
Mm. I think that's right.
I can't believe I can't get that. And you I also know
my
I'm
brain on it.
Modernity. I know. I can't even do modernity either.
You know what I found out the other day is my like really big, not speaking, but spelling brain Gulf is I can't spell restaurant.
Yeah.
Do you have one of those?
Oh my God. Anything with an IE.
I have no idea where the U.
Anything with an IE. I know the rule. I before E, except after C. I can't spell peace. I can't spell friends. I can't spell, like, honestly, like, I write it in it and I can never do it. Like,
those are pretty easy ones.
Yeah,
I mean,
I don't know what the friends thing is about. That may be
that's I before E.
Yeah, I know, but I can't. When I start to write it, I'm always like friend.
The problem with the I before E thing is there's just enough
exceptions yeah.
that you have to like really guard against it.
When I'm correcting Saul's spelling, like I feel like 40% of the time I'm going like, yeah, I know that doesn't make any sense. It's just that's just the way it is. Well, yeah.
That's English for you.
And then right. I say, and that's English. Matt Letch.
Okay, Brett Weinstein.
Yeah, you can't stop saying Brett Weinstein.
That's how you pronounce it.
It's not Weinstein?
No, it's Weinstein.
You say Harvey Weinstein too.
It is Harvey Weinstein.
Harvey Weinstein.
I think I say Harvey Weinstein, but it's the Weinsteins because they're just like that other guy whose name rhymes with them.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to put you on the spot. That's only what I do to Sam.
But yeah, I don't feel too on the spot. But on the spot for Left Reckoning this weekend, we had Victor Poggi talking about Bolsonaro's apology for trying to do a coup at the Supreme Court and how his far right people are handling that. And then also coming up, we have David Girard. He's a no coiner. We're going to talk crap about Bitcoin a little bit. But also, we're going to talk about blockchain, how that's also bad, and how smart contracts are dumb, and all this stuff is stupid. And it's just thinly veiled boosterism for a speculative asset controlled by rich people. So that is this week. Patreon.com/leftreckoning for the Patreon show. And go subscribe to the YouTube channel.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a, whoa, what a fucking nightmare! Nightmare!
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Come on. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.